When they're traveling, people from Michigan are often asked, hey, how's Detroit doing? The largest municipal bankruptcy and the subsequent stories about Detroit's revival have captured the curiosity of the rest of the nation and the world. Detroit's successes in its business districts, downtown and midtown, get most of the attention. Every billionaire acquisition, every refurbished building, every taxpayer-assisted development have contributed to the conclusion that Detroit is America's comeback city. But billionaire investments in skyscrapers, sports stadiums, and the opening of trendy stores and restaurants don't tell you much about how the residents of the city are doing. If you want to know the real story of Detroit, you have to go to the neighborhoods. I'm Lester Graham. All this year, I've been visiting one neighborhood in Detroit to find out how it's doing and reporting what that says about Detroit as a whole. This documentary is the final report of that effort by Michigan Radio and the Detroit Journalism Cooperative. We're calling it, How's Detroit Doing? Welcome. This is How's Detroit Doing, a special documentary from Michigan Radio and the Detroit Journalism Cooperative. I'm Lester Graham. The Morningside neighborhood is on the east side of Detroit, right on the border of the suburb Grosse Pointe Park. It borders one of Detroit's better neighborhoods, East English Village. Eric DeWicke is a longtime resident of Morningside. He's also a lecturer in the Urban and Regional Planning Program at the Taubman College at the University of Michigan.
Morningside isn't the worst neighborhood. It isn't the best neighborhood. But in a lot of respects, I think it's representative of Detroit neighborhoods. And if we can't save this one, we're really in deep doo-doo because Morningside has a lot going for it.
There are nearby supermarkets such as Kroger and Trader Joe's in Grosse Pointe. There's an Aldi in a shopping plaza adjacent to Morningside. There are nearby pharmacies, services, and nice restaurants on Mack Avenue. And Morningside itself is home to a lot of very nice brick Tudors and bungalows. Its demographics reflect the population of Detroit overall, about 80% African American, a little more than 10% white. The rate of poverty is relatively high, like most of Detroit, but most of the residents feel there's great potential in Morningside. Early this year, February, Lenora McElrath took me for a slow walk around her block in the neighborhood of Morningside. The sidewalks were snow-packed and slick. On this block, the city of Detroit said it would demolish three abandoned houses in 2016. They were still standing in February. They're still standing today. The city's demolition website indicates they're now in the pipeline, which means they're among the 1,500 demolitions in the city next on the list. In the meantime, the windows are broken out, doors are gone, they've been stripped of anything of value. Now open to the elements, the buildings are deteriorating. McElrath shakes her head looking at them. She remembers when she moved here 23 years ago, and she was struck by the beauty of her new neighborhood.
The first thing I noticed was all the trees. It was just beautiful. And it's going down. But we're not going to give up. That's the big thing, not giving up.
We walk in silence for a while, avoiding the slippery patches on the sidewalk, and I try to imagine what she just described. It's not that difficult. There are rows and rows of well-kept brick homes on the surrounding blocks, and some of those majestic trees still line the streets. But there are gaps in some blocks, vacant lots where houses once stood, burned out houses that have not been demolished. There are a lot of reasons Morningside is in the state it is. White flight, mortgage foreclosures after predatory lending schemes, and more recently, houses sit vacant because they've been lost to tax foreclosure.
I'll take you down to the south side.
That same day, Ulysses Jones drove me around Morningside. He's a friend and neighbor of Lenora McElrath. He's also on the board of the community organization, also called Morningside.
Well, this section of Morningside, the southeast section, was primary area for Habitat.
Habitat for Humanity.
Yes. And also with Youth Snapback.
Here, there are a few blocks of newer, pretty two-story houses. And when we reached the end of the last block, the house on the end was missing its front door.
One of the Habitat houses, I think, that have been ransacked, doors missing, and it's unsecured.
So it doesn't take much of a hint for scrappers to move in?
No.
This is a big problem in Morningside and just about every other neighborhood in Detroit. If there's the slightest clue that the house is empty, scrappers descend. Once that happens, the chances of someone buying it and making it a home again are slim. In this particular case, though, you snapped back, moved in quickly. In a couple of days, the door was replaced and the house was boarded up until it could be sold again. That's rare in this city. Lenora McElrath says it's often left to the neighborhoods to make sure a house is not broken into by scrappers.
You know, if they strip it to the point where somebody might not want it, you know, it's just going to sit there. So we made it our business to watch out for that house.
It might not be immediately apparent, but at times there are vacant houses on her block. McElrath says she and her neighbors watch constantly to make sure no one breaks into them.
You know, because we question them. Can I help you? If you know no one lives there, you know, you ask questions. Can I help you? When dealing with these situations, I don't necessarily like to be confrontational because, you know, I'm up in age. But when you come into my neighborhood and you think you're going to get away with doing something, that's not happening.
The neighbors also make the vacant houses appear lived in. During the summer, they mow the lawns, they trim the bushes, they pick up leaflets left door to door. In the winter, they shovel the snow off the sidewalk. When that doesn't happen, things go badly. Just a couple of blocks away, another longtime resident, Doris Bryant, says high taxes, foreclosures, and scrappers cause destruction. She says no one in authority seems capable of stopping it.
Here, they just let them become destroyed, stripped, and whatever, and they just become what you see. You know?
Do you see scrappers in your neighborhood?
I have seen them, and then before when that house was over there, it was a beautiful house with nothing wrong with it, you know. And I saw scrappers in the neighborhood taking the windows and the doors out the house, and called the police, and they said that was the lowest thing on their priority, you know. So they had other things, and they didn't ever come. People took all the windows, the doors, and everything. It became a shell. They tore it down, and it's a lot.
This doesn't happen by accident. In any given year, about 1 out of 5 of the more than 4,000 homes in Morningside are at risk of foreclosure. Some owners arrange payment plans. But still, each year, hundreds of homes in this neighborhood actually end up being seized and auctioned. This is the second wave of foreclosures. A lot of homes were lost to mortgage foreclosures starting in 2006 after the subprime predatory lending schemes caused the housing bubble to burst. The result is decimated neighborhoods in most of Detroit. Between 1970 and 2010, Detroit lost more than 228,000 occupied housing units, according to a recent report by the Urban Institute. How did this decline start?
Between 1948 and 1963, Detroit loses somewhere in the ballpark of 130,000 manufacturing jobs.
Thomas Segrue is the author of the definitive book on why Detroit declined. Its title is The Origins of the Urban Crisis. Those mostly auto manufacturing jobs started leaving the city to be built either in the suburbs of Detroit or places where labor was cheaper. White people started leaving the city following the jobs. Many black residents could not. That's because sometimes the suburbs were off limits to people of color. Federal programs discriminated, real estate agencies steered them away, banks wouldn't loan to African Americans if they attempted to buy in certain areas. The population of Detroit steadily declined from nearly 2 million people in 1950 to about 700,000 people today. The city is now about 80% African American. Even when Detroit was majority white, Segrue says racial lines were strictly drawn.
You can't underestimate the intensity of that segregation in housing and the role that it played in dividing metropolitan Detroit by race.
He says that was not only the case between the city and the suburbs, but within the city as well.
Large sections of Detroit were home to almost all African Americans, and vice versa. Large sections of the outlying neighborhoods in Detroit and the suburbs were nearly entirely white.
That was the case in Morningside. It had been home to many high-skilled blue-collar workers. Most of the white workers left over time. By the 1990s, a lot of the only higher-paid workers still in Morningside were City of Detroit employees. They were required by ordinance to live in the city. But for years, a few of the white firefighters and police in Detroit violated that ordinance. Some even bragged about having a house in the suburbs while keeping a house or apartment in the city where they got their mail. The other white city employees who followed the rules often lived in neighborhoods closest to the city limits of Detroit, such as Morningside. Back in 1993, Marilyn Nash Yazbek opened a pharmacy there.
Now, when I came over, we had a lot of firemen, there were a lot of police officers, and there were a lot of teachers who were in this area, you know, in terms of jobs and everything. The homes were owned, maybe some were renting, and at some point it changed over. There was a lot of movement out of the neighborhood, so the wealth did go.
That started right around the year 2000. Bill McGraw reported for the Free Press at the time.
A significant portion of the police and fire departments lobbied for years in Lansing and fought really hard to get the legislature, which controlled this issue, to do away with residency.
80 cities across the state had residency requirements. White firefighters and police in Detroit and Flint lobbied hardest to end the practice. In December 1999, the legislature passed the Residency Act, which ended cities' abilities to require their employees to live in the city they served. Bill McGraw notes this was an important moment, but not the most significant exodus of people from Detroit.
People were leaving Detroit during those years for the usual reasons. They wanted what they thought would be a safer environment and better schools, for instance. And it's hard to say how much the ending of residency played a role, but it obviously contributed to the change of Detroit neighborhoods.
With many of the Detroit police officers and firefighters leaving the neighborhoods for the suburbs, a lot of them turned their Detroit homes into rentals. Even that didn't last in some cases. A locksmith in the Morningside neighborhood said over the years, many of those owners got tired of the hassles of being landlords and then simply abandoned their houses. There's been one more hit involving city employees. Those city employees who retired and stayed in their old neighborhood saw their pensions cut in 2014. Jackie Grant works with her neighbors in Morningside, helping them to avoid tax foreclosures. She said those pension cuts hurt.
We were in bankruptcy, right, in the city of Detroit. And so people that were already retired lost a good portion of pension, which changed their whole financial future. That's when I think a lot of homes really began to be lost.
Detroit is actively recruiting more neighborhood people into the police and firefighting ranks. If successful, and if those recruits stay in Detroit, it will still be years before the neighborhoods, such as Morningside, start seeing a significant benefit. You're listening to How's Detroit Doing from Michigan Radio and the Detroit Journalism Cooperative. Coming up, we'll talk with some of the remaining businesses in Morningside about the changes and the challenges they face today.
Ms. McElrath, when you think about your neighborhood, what does it tell you about how Detroit's doing?
You know, when people started losing their jobs and this and that, it affected it, you know, to the point that we have what we have. How Detroit is doing, from my perspective, from looking at my area, I know they're doing a lot of things downtown. That's wonderful. But I'm waiting to see when you're going to bring that back into, when it's going to come into the neighborhoods. You know, fine, downtown is great, but let's see some progress in the neighborhood, and then I feel better about that.
You're listening to How's Detroit Doing, a special documentary from Michigan Radio and the Detroit Journalism Cooperative. I'm Lester Graham. In the Morningside neighborhood, the main business strip is East Warren Avenue, which runs right through the middle of the neighborhood.
East Warren used to be a major shopping spot.
There were businesses in every building on Warren.
No matter what you needed, you could find it on Warren Avenue. The grocery stores, the movie theater.
A tailor, or a woodworking store, Five and Dime, whatever.
These are all business owners who have run decades-old businesses on East Warren. They say back in the day it was so busy that finding a place to park was difficult and the sidewalks bustled into the evening. Eric DeWicke invited me on a ride around his neighborhood. He's the lecturer at the University of Michigan we heard from earlier. He's driving me down East Warren Avenue.
I'd guess 50% are boarded up, and then you see all these vacant spaces here. This is where buildings have recently been torn down.
DeWicke points to buildings that used to house popular restaurants, professional offices, and busy banks. They're all empty now.
Really, this is a problem not just in Morningside, but it's a problem all over Detroit of what do we do with our former retail strips that there really isn't a demand for.
Demand is down because a lot of Morningside residents just don't have a lot to spend. This summer, I spoke to Bill Kamen, who ran the Hammer Time True Value Hardware Store.
It's about not having money to buy stuff around here. They're spending 60, 70% of their money on rent, and they don't have the extra money to be working on houses and putting into stuff.
And without disposable income, it's tough for the existing businesses and risky to start new businesses. Marilyn Nash-Yazbek owns Nottingham Pharmacy. She's also one of the very few longtime African-American business owners in Morningside.
I'm not really sure what will really thrive here because of the economics of the area. I think that has a lot to do with it.
Just down the street, Patrick Mayer runs Eastside Locksmiths. It's been operating in Morningside since 1939, and he says he thinks the area just needs a kickstart.
I understand that everybody wants to put the money downtown, but I mean, and not knowing a whole lot about a lot of the other neighborhoods, but knowing a lot about this particular one, we need some help.
What kind of help? Brian Pekelik has some ideas. He was the last president of the business association along East Warren Avenue before it folded several years ago. He runs Bike Tech a little farther east on Warren, just down the street from Morningside. He'd like to see the city do a few things.
To quickly and efficiently take care of the abandoned buildings, board it up, keep the neighborhood clean, safe, and lit.
But Bill Kamen at Hammertime Hardware is not sure that right now is the time to help Morningside.
I don't think that this side of Detroit has hit bottom yet. So maybe throwing good money after bad where the other neighborhoods are showing signs of a rebirth or something, that money might be better used in those areas than here.
A couple of weeks after I interviewed Bill Kamen, he closed Hammertime Hardware. The building now sits empty. Some money is getting funneled to a few Detroit neighborhoods, but not the ones that need it the most. Mayor Mike Duggan is working to help some of the better neighborhoods first.
I get asked, it seems like every day, you've got all this investment in downtown and midtown. It's great, I like it, but when's the investment coming to the neighborhoods?
In this year's State of the City speech, the mayor announced a neighborhood development program amounting to $30 million in investments from public and private sources.
We're starting in three neighborhoods to prove it makes a difference. In the Livernois-McNichols area, in the West Village area on the east side, and in southwest Detroit near Clark Park.
These three neighborhoods are already doing better than many others in the city. Livernois-McNichols includes Marygrove College and abuts the campus of the University of Detroit Mercy. The West Village area is full of apartment buildings, nice duplexes, a few trendy restaurants, with more retail stores planned. The area near Clark Park is better known as Mexican Town. It's been a growing and vibrant area for a while. This approach is like reverse battlefield triage. Instead of helping the most damaged areas of the city first, Mayor Duggan is helping those neighborhoods with the greatest potential. As a strategy, it might make some sense. Invest where you'll see the difference in a more notable way. If you live in one of the other neighborhoods, such as Morningside, it's frustrating.
If we can't, the city, if we can't save Morningside, then what hope is there for Detroit's comeback?
That's the urban planning expert, Eric Dewicki. He wants Mayor Duggan to make Morningside a higher priority. He had a brief conversation with the mayor last year about the street where Dewicki lives, 3 Mile Drive.
And he said, we've got some work to do on 3 Mile. And I said, yes, we do, Mr. Mayor. So I think if the mayor understands 3 Mile and he understands we have these issues and we still aren't getting changes to the system, what must other neighborhoods who don't have that advantage have to go through?
Now, of all the streets and neighborhoods in the city, why does Mike Duggan know 3 Mile Drive in Morningside? Well, Duggan's grandparents lived on 3 Mile, and as a child, he spent a lot of time there during summer breaks. Dewicki credits the mayor for new streetlights, more regular garbage pickup, a new small park in Morningside. At the same time, Dewicki feels the mayor and City Hall are not listening to residents.
What I feel is the kind of modus operandi of the administration, for the most part, is, well, we hire all these smart people and these experts, and we understand what the issue is and what needs to be done. And so, yeah, we don't really need your help, people out there in the neighborhoods.
That's a pretty consistent sentiment among people in Detroit's neighborhoods. Mayor Duggan disagrees. He says they are listening. He noted in the Livernois-McNichols neighborhood, 40 meetings were held to see what the neighbors wanted. People in Morningside would be happy to get a chance to tell the mayor what they wanted for their community. They also hope Duggan remembers his grandparents' neighborhood when more investments are made in neighborhoods with potential. It's no wonder that the neighborhoods are asking the mayor about help. While Detroit's downtown business districts are booming, research shows the people in the neighborhoods are not sharing in that prosperity. The neighborhoods are actually declining.
You've got a huge jobs deficit in the neighborhoods.
That's Gary Sands. He's a professor emeritus at Wayne State University's Department of Urban Studies and Planning.
And when you bring jobs into Midtown or downtown, whether it be Quicken Loans or Microsoft or whoever, it doesn't do as much good for the people who are in the neighborhoods.
Sands research reveals that Detroit's recovery has largely benefited people who don't live in Detroit at all.
Data on payrolls and income from employment for Detroit, it's going up in downtown Midtown, but in every other area of the city, the total payrolls are going down. The average wage rate in downtown Midtown is perhaps four or five times what it is in the neighborhoods. And that's not sustainable.
People who don't live in Detroit hold two out of every three jobs in the city. What will it take to employ more city residents? Sands' analysis says Detroit needs these things: better public education, better access to transportation, and programs that foster entrepreneurship in the neighborhoods. None of those things is a quick fix.
I mean, it's taken six decades to decline to the point where we are today. It's not going to be fixed in the next 3 years.
When I talked to the longtime merchants still in business in Morningside, they were not optimistic about the neighborhood either. Some of them mentioned that crime was still a major problem, and they didn't think the police were patrolling as much as they should be.
The police response is terrible. The police presence is terrible. Next door's been robbed a number of times.
That's Patrick Mayer of Eastside Locksmith again. Next door to his shop is the Family Dollar store. In January, a clerk was shot in a robbery attempt. The night before that shooting, just down the street at Nottingham Pharmacy, there was another attempted crime. Marilyn Nash Yazbek at Nottingham Pharmacy says her business has been broken into so many times that the 5th Precinct Police Station knows her well. The latest time, burglars used the sledgehammer to try to break through the concrete block wall.
So I've had my crime. You know it happens and you get upset, but crime is everywhere.
Police interrupted that break-in. I spent part of a day riding around Morningside with Officer DeAndre Gaines. He was the neighborhood patrol officer at that time. That's Detroit's version of community policing. I asked him about the merchants' concerns that police were not around enough.
Well, we are out here in Morningside. Personally, I'm out here as well as the other MPOs.
Detroit's reputation as a high crime city has not gone away, but its crime rate is down substantially. It's been falling since the 1980s. Still, there are areas of the city that are not as safe as others. But Officer Gaines thinks the perceptions of crime in Morningside are overblown.
Morningside is still a good area. You know, everywhere in the city you're going to have your pockets of crime. You know, that's everywhere. But I wouldn't say Morningside is no different than any of the other areas in the city of Detroit.
Morningside is in Detroit's 5th precinct, as we mentioned before. The Detroit Police Department provided crime stats for all the precincts to us. The 5th's crime stats seem to be about average for the city, but when you calculate the number of crimes per 10,000 residents, the 5th precinct has the second highest crime rate among the 12 precincts. Riding along in the squad car, Officer Gaines spotted someone he knew out in the yard. So we stopped to talk to retired fire department captain David Brown, and I told him what the merchants and people had been telling me.
They get the idea that they don't see any police officers. Have you found that to be true or not?
That's true.
You're talking to one right
now? I'm talking to one. You see one on occasion, but there's not enough of them.
Brown thinks too often the police are tied up answering 911 calls to have time to patrol the residential streets as much as he'd like. We also stopped by Zena Knight's house. She's the block captain here, and she thinks crime is up in Morningside.
It's getting worse. It's about them not respecting the police. You know, a lady just got killed at that corner house last Saturday. I can't give you an answer to what it's really causing the problem right now, but it's not for the like of them.
She was looking right at Officer Gaines. She made it clear that she thinks the police are doing their job around here. And Detroit does seem to have the right level of officers on the street. According to FBI statistics, Detroit actually has more than the average number of cops for its population. In 2015, in larger cities in the Midwest, for every 10,000 people, the average was 29 officers. Detroit had 33 officers. Of course, Detroit is geographically a very big place. The city has struggled in recent years to cut its response time to 911 calls. But Neighborhood Patrol Officer DeAndre Gaines says Morningside residents see a lot of him.
We are patrolling an area at least 5 days a week, various hours, depending on where the complaints take us. We also do what we call safe passage, which is assisting the children getting to school safe. I do that along with NPO Scott. So we're out there morning and evening making sure this community is safe.
And that's just the neighborhood officers. Other patrol officers are also working 24/7. Officer Gaines says if the neighborhood and the business owners really want to be sure of more police presence, more businesses should sign up for Detroit's Green Light Initiative.
We're trying to get businesses to get on the system where we can actually monitor their cameras live from a feed down at the City of Detroit headquarters. It's a very high-def camera where if something happens, it's recorded, we can get license plates, we can do facial recognition, very, very good evidence in case a crime happens.
According to the city's website, nearly 200 businesses have signed up since it started in January of last year. Only a few of them are in the Morningside neighborhood. It's not cheap. A business has to spend between $4,000 to $6,000 or more for the equipment. The city made arrangements with a cable company to offer a program of $1,000 down and about $140 a month to lease digital storage and camera equipment.
You see the green light flashing right here?
Oh, yeah.
Also, we have signs right here, and you have signs on the door. So let's go in and take a look.
We're at the Maryland Liquor Store on Mack Avenue. You cannot miss all the signs indicating this is a green light business.
What's up, man? All right,
what's up?
You all right? Get your sign-in sheet on you.
At random times throughout the day, the police are mandated to visit the store, sign and date a sign-in sheet. Mustafa Almuhi was working at the liquor store this particular morning. What do you think of it?
Okay. Oh, man, it's working.
Is it?
Yeah, it feels a lot safer. Feels a lot better, you know what I mean? Knowing that, you know, you're being watched, being protected, you know, at all times.
So have you seen a reduction in problems here?
Definitely. And if they don't know, you let them know. Hey, you know, we got the Detroit police watching over here, looking over us.
Officer Gaines says any business, a restaurant, gas station, pharmacy, can sign up for the green light.
And businesses that reported having a green light have seen a reduction in crime, also an increase in profit because people want to come shop at those businesses.
The city has been considering an ordinance that would require businesses open after 10 p.m. to enroll in the Green Light Initiative, but not every business wants to be forced to pay the costs of those cameras. Since Detroit's bankruptcy, priorities for the police department have changed. Yes, violent crime is still a top priority, but it's believed minor crimes can quickly lead to a neighborhood's decline. It's often called the broken window theory. Officer Gaines suggests that ignoring minor crimes can lead to more serious crimes.
If a window is broke, then someone will think no one cares about that property, and they'll start dumping on that property or squatting in that property or, you know, maybe trying to do other illegal activities in that property.
While we're cruising the neighborhood streets, Gaines says he's looking for blight violations. He'll ticket property owners who don't properly board up vacant houses. He'll cite people for high grass, trash containers out when it's not pickup day, setting bulk items for trash pickup too early.
Different things like that. That's why mainly our top things that we look for to make the community look better, make it look more livable and make it, you know, the property value increase instead of decrease.
A lot of these vacant houses are owned by the Detroit Land Bank Authority. It owns thousands of them, including some in Morningside. Gaines says when he finds land bank properties have not been mown or need to be boarded up, the agency is quick to get someone out to take care of the issue. The land bank reports it's had to tear down 260 structures in the last 3 years in Morningside. They were too far gone to sell. 17 more are either contracted or in the pipeline for demolition. The land bank sells the houses that can be repaired. But some neighbors complain the land bank is not enforcing its own rules. When it sells a house, it's supposed to be fixed up and someone living there within 6 months. Some houses bought from the land bank have been sitting empty for 2 years. A spokesman for the land bank says they want to give the new owners every chance of success. If that means waiting a little longer, it's better than seizing the house and starting all over. You're listening to How's Detroit Doing? From Michigan Radio and the Detroit Journalism Cooperative. Coming up, we'll look at some projects that Morningside residents are excited about and hope will mean real and positive change for the neighborhood. What does what's happening in Morningside say about how Detroit's doing?
It's day and night. You have a downtown that people really want to spend the money, and yet why can't somebody open up something in this neighborhood? I guess I understand that nobody wants to build a hotel at the corner here because it's just not viable. It's just, you can't make any money off it, whereas you could spend your money downtown. I understand that. And if there's going to be the ripple effect from Detroit, it's a reminder. They've been trying to work on this downtown Detroit forever. And every time you get it to a recession and everything comes to a halt, and nothing ever seems to filter down to these neighborhoods.
You're listening to a special report, How's Detroit Doing? From Michigan Radio and the Detroit Journalism Cooperative. On a sunny day this fall, I stood outside the Public Foods grocery store on East Warren Avenue, talking to anyone who'd stop. I wanted to find out what people really wanted to see in their neighborhood. There were themes, like we've heard before, tearing down vacant houses was a top priority. According to City of Detroit data, in just the last 3 years, 266 houses have been torn down in Morningside. 17 more are scheduled. More than 13,000 vacant houses across the city have been demolished. Another issue was finding ways to help people fix up their homes.
They need to rebuild the houses, make it look a little more better.
How do you get loans to keep up your house, like doing your roofing? You know, because once your roof is gone, the whole house is gone.
You give them a helping hand to bring it up to code instead of using all that money to tear things down. There's no programs like that.
That was Ranisha Rayford, Jarrell Morgan, and Kenneth Kennedy. One of the things you notice in many Detroit neighborhoods are houses with big blue tarps protecting the roof. A lot of folks can't afford to reshingle them. Andre Spivey is Morningside's city council member. He says there are some low-interest programs.
But you have to qualify for them. We do have CDBG grant dollars. Those go to organizations in the community, but then they can't serve the entire east side or all of Morningside.
So we'll continue to see those blue tarps for now. Another problem facing the neighborhood is about to be turned into what's expected to be a real asset for Morningside.
Probably the biggest issue in Morningside is this illegal dumping.
That's Neighborhood Patrol Officer Andre Gaines. There are favorite places where people dump, such as Barham Street.
It's the perfect dumping ground. You know, you don't have many houses.
Yeah, there's a couple of couches and a bunch of other trash as we're driving by. I've driven this street many, many times now, and there's always something new that's been dumped.
There's always something new, and you got City of Detroit DPW out here.
That day, two different crews of Detroit's Department of Public Works were cleaning up construction debris, piles of tree limbs, furniture, and just household trash dumped along the street. It's hard to say who's dumping. One business put up cameras and signs warning illegal dumpers they were being recorded. Stuff is still dumped there. Big trucks sometimes dump concrete construction debris in the middle of the night. Few people are caught. One of the nonprofit organizations known for building affordable housing is You Snap Back. It's headquartered here in the Morningside neighborhood. Linda Smith is the executive director. She says they've been wondering what should be done about Barham Street. Not that long ago, some University of Michigan students examined it.
One of the professors came to me to talk about doing some open lots, some space, some farmway, looking at the possibility of what could we do with Barham.
So they applied for a grant from the Kresge Foundation. Kresge has been running a pilot program, and this year it supported 17 new projects in the neighborhoods. They include greenways, community hubs, youth engagement, artists in parks, and more. The Morningside Project got $150,000 of the $2 million distributed this year. Brian Hogel is a program officer with Kresge.
Basically what the grant does is that allows them to do some work to transform a half-mile stretch of Barham that's highly vacant into a greenway and farmway. This is land that's been the place of a lot of dumping and blight, and they're looking to change that and change it from a liability for the neighborhood into an asset.
With all the problems many of the neighborhoods in Detroit face, you have to wonder, why a greenway? Hogel says Kresge's partners, the neighborhood organizations, meet with the residents. Lots of ideas are gathered, and they build a consensus around a few of the good ones. In Morningside, Linda Smith says people wanted a place to walk dogs, a place for kids to ride their bicycles, and more fresh food. This agricultural greenway will do all of that, and it should be self-sustaining. Farmers will lease the land. Smith says there's a demand by farmers who want space to grow food.
They want to be able to just grow their crop like anyone else, but they don't want to deal with the land bank. They don't want to deal with the city. They want to be able to lease land that's already been prepped to do what they want to do. So that's what's exciting.
Although Smokey wasn't happy about it, I talked with Marvin, who lives next to Barham Street. He didn't want to give his last name.
It's a good idea as long as they keep it clean. And if they plant a garden in there for all the neighbors to participate, it'd be a good thing for them.
One of the things we're talking about is actually leasing it to farmers who would grow crops and then sell them to the neighbors.
That'd be good, too. We need something in the neighborhood so people can get more interacting with the neighbors. Yep, that's what we need.
One of the few houses along Barham that faces the street is a neat brick house where Faith Williams lives. She recently bought a vacant lot next door. The Barham Greenway will adjoin that lot.
That sounds nice to me. It sounds like a very good idea. Yeah. I would even help them, you know, keep the greenery up.
Linda Smith at USNAP Back got some more help to make sure this project is successful. Chase Bank loaned four executives to the project for a month. They designed a business plan for the agricultural greenway. That's not the only encouraging project happening. Another could prove to be an anchor for the East Warren Avenue business strip in Morningside. There used to be dozens of movie theaters scattered all across Detroit's neighborhoods. Nearly all of them have been closed and demolished, but there are a handful left, and one of them is the Alger. Paul Phillips is a board member of the Morningside Community Organization. He says the Alger was once central to the area.
The Alger was one of our cornerstone facilities here in the Morningside area. There's been a long history of the Alger Theater, and we've been hoping that it would be restored soon.
The Alger opened in 1935.
How about the phone, Robinson? You've got 2 hours to make the deadline.
Kansas City calling.
The movie theater was a major source of entertainment. Plus, the Alger Theater had air conditioning long before it was common in homes. That made those summer matinees especially appealing. But by the 1980s, the Alger was falling on hard times. A nonprofit group formed in 1983. The Friends of the Alger Theater bought the building a couple of years later. For more than three decades, the group has been slowly renovating the theater.
We are looking to activate a community center here on the corner of Warren and Outer Drive that serves these Eastside community members. It'll be available for their use. We will do programming as well as hopefully house different performing arts groups, could be educational groups. We are going to be doing all things including film.
That's Friends of the Alger Theater board member Melissa Bunker.
So as I look around, there are parts of the theater that, you know, look okay, and then there are other parts that look pretty damaged. I mean, there's exposed pipes because of rotting plaster. It hasn't been painted for a while. Looks like a lot of work ahead of you.
What we've done thus far is work that you can't see. We've done asbestos remediation. It's expensive, it's not sexy, and no one can see it.
In the past few years, the Friends of the Alger Group has raised $250,000 to revive the theater. That's just shy of the total needed for the latest improvements. That money came from neighbors, the Lear Corporation, and the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. Those new improvements are more obvious. They're happening on the outside of the building. Paul Phillips says it's got the residents talking.
People are wondering what's getting ready to happen there, especially since they've been redoing the storefronts there. And then there's also been buzz since last summer that there's going to be something happening on the rooftop. They've seen sketches, but no one has really seen what's going to be there. So there's excitement.
The rooftop will be the site of an outdoor patio. One of the stores going into the street-level retail spaces is an ice cream parlor. Christopher Riley is renovating that storefront now.
I have my own creamery, Riley Craft Creamery, located here in Detroit, and I want to open up a retail location here at the Alger Theater.
Riley lives in the East English Village neighborhood adjacent to Morningside. He says opening in Midtown or Corktown might have been a better business decision, but...
Those neighborhoods don't need any help. I really kind of see like the seeds of a real turnaround and renaissance. But no one's going to move over here unless there's some cool services. And I'm really excited about this Alger project because I think this project's going to serve to really be like the anchor of these neighborhoods in the area, you know, to finally see some resurgence.
Another retailer plans to open a coffee shop in a second storefront. The added benefit is that the Alger Theater will have tenants and a regular source of income to supplement the nonprofit's fundraising efforts. Melissa Bunker with Friends of the Alger says the theater is not in perfect shape, but it can be used right now. The group had one-third of the theater's seats fixed and cleaned. There's a small screen. Some events have already been held there. Bunker predicts in the near future, the Alger will once again be the place to hold events and performances for the surrounding neighborhoods and the next-door Grosse Pointe suburbs.
We are in a very unique geographic position to be able to draw a very large market. And we can seat, when we get these seats up and going, you know, 600-700 people. Where can you do that? Nowhere.
There's optimism there, but Bunker says what they really need are more volunteers and more money to bring the Alger back for Detroit's East Side. Earlier this year, I was contacted by one of Morningside's new residents. Ted Shoemaker discovered the great housing stock in the neighborhood.
Morningside was not something that I saw in my plans at all until I... you know, started driving around and noticed this house came up, and I was like, wow, this is a cool little pad here. And I like it a lot.
He was also attracted to the advantages of Morningside with its proximity to the suburbs and to Lake St. Clair, which is just a bike ride away for him. But that cool little pad, he found a brick house on a corner lot complete with leaded glass windows, hardwood floors, a fireplace, and it's spacious.
It's 2,100 square feet. It's got a three-car garage, two floors, had five bedrooms. I knocked down one to expand the kitchen and paid $68,000 for it. I feel like that was kind of expensive for Morningside. but yeah, the house still got great bones. Most of the original features are... still intact, and they kept it pretty well.
If this house were just a few blocks away in Grosse Pointe Park, the house would have cost 4 to 5 times as much. Shoemaker says he's been settling in, getting to know his neighborhood.
You know, I try to reach out to my neighbors. I've got I know pretty much everyone within a 4 to 5 house radius on my block.
That includes Ida Brown, who lives right across the street.
You know, he was friendly, but you know, I don't bother you when you're not too friendly.
Brown is in her 80s. She's lived in Morningside for 3 years, but until she met Shoemaker, she really hadn't gotten to know any of her neighbors.
I might could if I was more outgoing with people, but I just have never in my life been the person that goes and talk a lot to other people, you know. If they don't seem interested too much in me, I leave them alone. I don't bother.
Shoemaker checks in on her. So does her daughter. She takes her to the grocery store and to appointments. Not all senior citizens are that fortunate. Many senior citizens end up living by themselves. In Detroit, 41% of people over 60 live alone, according to a report by Data Driven Detroit. Marianne Frazier owns M&D Pharmacy. She says a lot of her older customers are unable to leave home, even to pick up a prescription. She adds it appears too many of those seniors are alone and no one is checking on them.
A lot of times I don't think so. So my delivery girl checks on them.
And I talked to them on the phone.
Frazier started those deliveries specifically for the elderly shut-ins in the surrounding neighborhoods. In the same building, next to the pharmacy, Betty Wright has opened a senior daycare center. She's named Tobe Mack. She's a retired nurse and physician's assistant and wants to help seniors to be active. So far, Wright is not being swamped with paying customers.
Well, right now, no one's paying. And that's okay.
Wright used her own savings to launch the Tobe Mack Senior Daycare Center. The rent? Well, pharmacist Marianne Frazier owns the building, and rent payments are, well, let's just say she's allowing a delay. Wright is frustrated because so far the agencies that could make funds available say they are out of money. The center is cozy with nice furniture provided by Wright. It's kind of like a tiny hotel lobby, and then there's additional space for exercise and craft activities. When I visited, a group of women were chatting in an area decorated with some of their own art. Mamie Walker is a friend of Betty Wright's and a big advocate of getting the senior center off the ground.
We are all getting older, and we need a place where we can come, socialize, have Bible study, have exercise, being able to communicate with one another, and it's a relaxing place. Gives you peace of mind.
The other women, not in agreement. Betty Wright says for seniors who spend a lot of time alone, the little things mean a lot.
Just sitting with someone and chatting with them, I mean, it's so interesting to be in the midst of maybe three or four. Everyone wants to talk at the same time because they don't have a lot of opportunities to talk.
There's an economic argument for funding senior centers like this. Active seniors usually stay in their homes longer. That means a stay in the nursing home is shorter. At an average cost of $7,500 a month, almost 32% of all Medicaid goes to long-term care. Seniors who have Medicaid can get a waiver for a senior daycare, and that's a whole lot cheaper. But in a city of 700,000, Detroit only has about 20 senior daycare centers. Some of those operate out of houses. Detroit is a city where putting something together out of nothing to meet a need is normal. There's an old saying, making a way out of no way. It's how many neighborhoods take care of their people. Morningside is just part of a much larger story. It's part of the legacy of white flight of cities and institutional racism by government. Those facts are clearly laid out by researchers such as Thomas Sugrue.
To a great extent in the 1970s, 80s, 90s, and beyond, American cities fell to the bottom of the national public policy agenda. They fell to the bottom of state agendas in Lansing. It became harder and harder for places like Detroit to get the kind of support for rebuilding its decaying infrastructure, for showing up at schools. And increasingly, the city relied on its own tax base, which was shrinking dramatically as the population declined and as businesses continued to disappear.
Sugrue and other researchers over the last half century again and again point to the inequality between the races, which is reinforced by the federal government and states such as Michigan. It's just a little more stark in Detroit.
Power and resources and jobs and economic opportunity are still really unequally distributed across metropolitan areas. They won't get to the core problems of public education, which is that we have really separate and unequal systems of schooling in metropolitan Detroit that really limit people's opportunities. It won't get to the still really, really deeply entrenched patterns of residential segregation. Detroit still ranks among the top five most racially segregated metropolitan areas in the United States, and we haven't done very much to grapple with that.
Neighborhoods such as Morningside are struggling with those larger issues. The local people care, and they do what they can.
Ms. Grant, what is what's happening in Morningside tell you about how Detroit's doing?
Downtown is doing very well. But the majority of this city is in the neighborhoods. And there are a few communities that are really blossoming. Our community is not seeing very much happen. So we need our leaders to get busy and help us over here.
How's Detroit Doing? Was reported, written, and produced by Lester Graham. The principal editor was Sarah Hewlett. Additional editing from Vincent Duffy. Reporting assistance came from Nick Wallace and Mercedes Mejia. The concept for How's Detroit Doing came from Sandra Savoda of WDET and Bill McGraw. The Detroit Journalism Cooperative is a collaboration of Detroit Public TV, Bridge Magazine, WDET, New Michigan Media, and Michigan Radio. Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative on Michigan Radio comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.